should probably take the ability to read for granted, especially if it's always come easily to you. But reading is an extraordinarily complex process, one that researchers are still working to understand fully. We're devoting today's Please Explain to the matter of learning to read, and joining us now are two renowned experts who also happen to be married to each other, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the Audrey G. Ratner Professor in Learning Development at Yale University, Yale Center for Learning, Reading, and Attention, and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, the Charles and Helen Schwab Professor in Dyslexia and Learning Development at the Yale University School of Medicine, Chief of Pediatric Neurology, and also co-director of the Yale Center for Learning, Reading, and Attention. Both of them are also with the newly founded Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Glad to be here.
And I should point out that later in the show, we'll be taking listener calls at 212-433-9692. Sally, Temple Grandin was on our show yesterday, and she said that autistic people and all animals think in pictures, not words. Is that true? Haven't some chimps been shown to have the ability to read?
I'm not aware of chimps having the ability to read. I know chimps have been taught some words and can speak some words and phrases and understand them, but I'm not aware of any data showing that they can read. I would be surprised.
So it's only humans that have this ability?
I think so. It's very much a peculiarly human ability, a very unnatural one at that.
And what is it in our brains that allows us to translate squiggles on a page into complicated thoughts with meaning?
Well, that's a really good question. For very many years, people wondered, how do we translate these abstract lines and squiggles so that the words have meaning? And now I think we have a pretty good idea. And I think the best way to understand that is to contrast what we know about spoken versus written language. So what do we know about spoken language? We know that it first emerged a very, very long time ago. Depending on whom you ask, they'll say 50,000 years. Some will say a million years. Clearly, we'll never know exactly how long, but we know it's very long. We know that virtually all societies on Earth speak, and that we as human beings, our brain, we're genetically programmed, and our brains are hardwired for spoken language. So spoken language is natural. It's instinctive. It's innate. So when a newborn baby comes into the world, as our granddaughter Marielle did not too long ago, we know that all you have to do is put her in a speaking environment and she will learn to speak. You don't have to go out and get the spoken language curriculum.
And the kid picks up grammar immediately, that's as Noam Chomsky has pointed out.
Oh, yeah.
But we didn't learn to, we didn't develop written language until much later, so that is not genetically programmed?
Exactly. We, you know, written language is rather recent. It was actually invented by the Babylonians about 5,400 years ago. And until recently, most societies on Earth didn't read. And even now, some still rely primarily on spoken language. So that we as humans are not naturally hardwired. Our brains are not hardwired to read. So whereas spoken language is natural and instinctive and does not have to be taught, written language is artificial. It's acquired. It's distinctly unnatural, and it has to be taught. So then the question is, how do the letters on the page take on meaning? Well, they have to be connected to something that already has innate meaning. And now there's a great deal of evidence to indicate that what letters have to be connected to are the elemental sounds of spoken language. That's referred to as the phonology, because our brains are hardwired to process these sounds and convert them to meaning. So the big hump that the reader has to jump over is to learn how to convert these sounds into print, how to link the letters and the sounds.
Does that apply to all reading? After all, in Chinese, you're not really reading words that are connected to sounds.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And there's now growing evidence to indicate that even in logographic languages like Chinese, a significant portion of the figure, maybe as much as 30%, relates to sounds. And that children in China, for example, who have difficulty reading, they often, very frequently, make sound-based errors.
Bennett, what parts of the brain are active when we're reading?
Well, that's a very good question. And over the last decade or so, we've really learned a great deal about the neural systems in reading. And we've learned that because of the emergence of a remarkable technology of functional brain imaging, more specifically, functional magnetic resonance imaging. But, you know, it's interesting. Even before we've had this remarkable technology, neuroscientists had a sense of what the brain systems were involved in reading from studies of individuals who suffered brain injuries and lost their ability to read as long ago as the late 19th century. The great French neurologist named Jules Desjardins observed people who suddenly, well, for example, his cases that he described, people who woke up one morning unable to read. And when Desjardins followed these people for years, and when they died of usually heart attacks, he looked at their brains, examined their brains, and found areas of the brain that he believed had to be related to the person's inability to read because they were damaged and there was no other explanation for the brain injury. And those brain systems that Desjardins described in the 1890s are very much the same as the systems that we have found, and I mean, I'm using we for a community of neuroscientists who study brain systems and reading. And those systems are basically in the left hemisphere of the brain, the hemisphere that we know is related to language. And Sally's just described to you that the system that reading really depends on the ability to understand language. And so the systems that are involved are in the left hemisphere. There's a system in the front of the brain, in the left frontal lobe, an area that was described over 100 years ago by a man named Paul Broca, who described patients who were unable to speak. And that system, that area called Broca's area, is important in reading. We know that it's important in the ability to analyze words and, of course, to actually articulate words that are, if you're reading aloud. There are two other very important areas for reading, both in the left hemisphere, and those are areas in an area called the parietal-temporal region, which is at the junction of the parietal lobe and the temporal lobe. And again, in the left hemisphere, an area around where a German neurologist named Carl Wernicke described language difficulties. And that system, we know, is important in analyzing words and in comprehending words. There's a third area that's extremely important that's also in the left hemisphere. It's a little bit behind and below the parietal temporal region. It's an area that has been studied in great detail by a group of French neuroscientists led by Stan Dehaene and Laurent Cohn, who call it the word form area. And that's an extremely interesting area because it's the area that we now believe is critical for skilled or fluent reading. Dehaene and Cohn talk about that area as being that the neurons in that area have gone through what they call neuronal recycling, and it's an area, a very old area of the brain that during evolution has been used for many things, including visual perception. But those neurons in that region have been adapted by us as humans to help us read, not only and read very specifically, to read fluently, that is, accurately, rapidly, and with good intonation, and Sally can talk a little bit more about the critical importance of fluent reading, but it's that area of the brain, the word form area, that we now know, and I say we know with a great deal of assurance from many, many different kinds of studies, is critical for skilled reading. For example, if you image children's brains, using functional magnetic resonance imaging, the areas that are most active are those areas in this area, in this word form area, that are related to skilled fluent reading. So let me try to be...
Wait, before you do, can I jump in and tell everybody that they're listening to WNYC in New York? I'm Leonard Lopate, and my guests on today's Please Explain are Drs. Bennett Shaywitz and Sally Shaywitz of Yale. Go ahead.
Well, let me try to clarify that a little bit, Leonard. For example, when we image children, we don't just image the children, but we ask them to participate in reading tests and standardized reading tests. So we know how, on a standardized reading test, how well they read. And the children who read the best on the standardized reading tests are the children who activate this region in the word form area the most. So that's a very, very good evidence that this area, this word form area, is critical for skilled or fluent reading. So we also know from other kinds of information that if we, for example, patients who have epilepsy frequently undergo surgery for that epilepsy, and neuroscientists have studied people undergoing epilepsy surgery, and they've stimulated this area, this word form area, and they can, during an electric stimulation, they can show that this area, if this area is stimulated, the people will lose their ability to read rapidly. So there's a great deal of information about this word form area. We also know that that's very, very important, and the discovery of the reading systems in brain using functional brain imaging is critically important because it allows us to study not only good typical readers, but children who have dyslexia, for example, and to see differences in the brain systems in children and adults who are typical readers compared to children and adults who are dyslexic readers. And
Sally, do our brains recognize the words themselves or the letters or the sounds? And what happens if somebody is born without the ability to hear? How did they still learn to read the same as everyone else?
I'll answer the second part of your question first because it's such an intriguing one. And children who are born with a profound hearing loss do learn to read, but even at a college like Gallaudet, which is meant for people with severe hearing impairments, the typical reading level is much lower, maybe 7th grade or 8th grade or so. And then the question is, how do they learn to read then? And the belief is that they learn to read it from the vibrations, from the feeling that is made by articulating the sounds.
So the sound, we now believe that sound is critical to this? Or wasn't there another theory that we just recognize the shape of a word?
So let me jump in here, Leonard. So these systems, these three systems in the brain that are critical in reading, we know that there's a great deal of integration and connectivity in the brain. And the challenge for neuroscience now, and neuroscientists studying reading and dyslexia, is how do the systems connect? How do they integrate? We know Sally's described that the sound basis of reading is critical. We know that as a fact, and that's been demonstrated repeatedly over the last several decades. And we also know that you can read words fluently essentially by memorizing the word, the form of the word. And the question is, how do these systems integrate? How does the sound-based system and how does the visual system that is recognizing essentially the word itself. And it's not the form of the word, it's the actual letters in the word. The neurons in this word form area actually code. There are neurons that learn to code for the letters themselves and the groups of letters in the word. So it isn't that it's the shape of the word, it's the word itself.
Well, I've spoken to people who are dyslexic who tell me that they read in spirals, and the only way that they could, they learned to read for any real sense is to take speed reading or some other kind of course where you actually read three or four words together and do it in a more gestalt method. Does that make sense to you?
It only makes sense if you're considering that they're learning to memorize groups of words, because there's a great deal of evidence to support the belief that dyslexic individuals who are compensating for their dyslexia are reading are essentially memorizing groups of words. Sally might want to comment about the speed reading, because that I don't want your listeners to get the sense that speed reading is the answer to dyslexia. Sally, did you want to?
I think I've gotten a big hint here. Well, what we know, and that's really important, and if I may just backtrack a moment, we know that as children begin to learn to read, they learn how to read accurately, and that's what I refer to as a manual or slow process. And as children read words over and over again, they learn to read the words not only accurately but fluently, and Bennett and I keep referring to that because that becomes very important. When a child or an adult learns to read a word fluently, that means that person can read it automatically. What does that mean, automatically? That means they can read it very rapidly, but even more than that, they can read it without thinking about it. It becomes virtually obligatory. You see it, you know what it means. It's a fast, automatic process. You don't even need to think about it. So, in fact, one of the hallmarks of having a reading problem or being dyslexic is having to read rather than automatically, having to read slowly or manually. So if you're a typical reader, you have the word form area Bennett was describing available to you. So you look at a word and you're automatically on the superhighway to reading. You look at the word and you know it, and it's a pleasure and it's instantaneous. If you're dyslexic, you are blocked from that superhighway, the word form area, and you have to get off and take a secondary road, a secondary neural route. And it's more circuitous and it's slower, so you can get to the word, but it's going to take you longer. And also, because it's not automatic, you're going to soak up a lot of attention and a lot of energy. So people who have dyslexia not only read slowly, but they do so with a great deal of effort, and it can be tiring. And also, if there are any distractions around, they will be taken off the reading.
My guests are Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the Audrey G. Ratner Professor in Learning Development at Yale University, and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, the Charles and Helen Schwab Professor in Dyslexia and Learning Development at the Yale University School of Medicine. Both of them are with the newly founded Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, and later we will also find out what they've learned from the Connecticut Longitudinal Reading Study that they have been conducting. We will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 when we return from a break. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Sally Shaywitz and Bennett Shaywitz of Yale University on Please Explain, talking about reading and how it happens. And our number here is 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, I just want to talk a bit about sounding out words. That is based on phonemes, isn't it? Isn't that what we do first before we get to the point that you were describing, Sally, where we don't even think twice about what the word is?
Exactly. Reading is based on speaking. And as children learn to speak, very young, maybe a 3-4-year-old, learn to focus on a part of a word. That's how children enjoy Dr. Seuss so much and the rhymes, because to appreciate a rhyme, you have to look at a small part of a word. And a phoneme is defined as a very elemental unit of language, the smallest unit of spoken language that makes a difference in meaning.
Does English present more problems than many languages because of the inconsistency of the sounding out of the letters?
You bet it does. English is, in fact, one of the most difficult of the languages because there is such a level of unpredictability between the letters and sounds. Other languages, I think, like Finnish or even Spanish, have much, much greater level.
Just one more thing before we go to the calls. You mentioned that this is a left brain activity, and years ago there was a bestseller about how men's brains are different than women's brains, the left and right hemisphere. Do women and men read differently?
No, they do not. Actually, we published a paper showing men's and women's brain process language somewhat differently, but they actually read the same, and that's really important to know.
Well, I think it's also important, not only do men and women read the same, but boys and girls read the same, or just about the same. And so when you haven't talked much about dyslexia, which is sort of the converse of typical reading, but for years the dogma was that only boys were poor readers, and in fact that's not the case. Boys and girls are equally subject to having reading problems like dyslexia.
In fact, they're unlike autism, dyslexia is pretty much equal, male, female?
Pretty much. There may be a few more boys, but not statistically significantly.
Let's go to our first caller, who is Bob from Brooklyn. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Very interesting discussion. I have a little twist on this to ask you about. I have a son who is a senior in the top high school in New York City. He has had what's been called dysgraphia virtually his whole school career, and has been in occupational therapy for all these years since elementary school. He's made virtually, as we can see, almost no improvement all these years, and it's given him a lot of trouble in terms of doing his schoolwork, taking notes, and so on. Been very frustrating for him. He can type. He has dexterity that's apparently normal. I'd like to know in what way this dysgraphia might be connected up with the research that you're doing.
Well, what we know, and that's a very good question, is in fact many children and adults who have reading difficulties also are dysgraphic. It's almost just as they have difficulty formulating and articulating the phonemes, these individual sounds, they have difficulty when they have to write them. So that's a very, very common area of difficulty. And
he reads very well, though.
Yeah, well, that could be. Sometimes people read well, but they don't read as fluently as they might. But given that, what we recommend is that people actually learn to keyboard at very early ages. There's so much assistive technology available now that children and adults who have difficulty with handwriting, with dysgraphia, which is difficulties with handwriting, really can be excellent on the keyboard. And there's also very good speech-to-print technology now. And so we think, why torment someone for years and years and years and some of that technology probably was not available when your son was younger. But for your listeners who have younger children, really early on in primary school, children can be taught how to keyboard, and it really can change their lives.
Go ahead.
One thing you might want to amplify on, Sally, is that keyboarding is an accommodation for dysgraphia, but there are accommodations for individuals who are not the best readers as well. You might want to touch on those.
Right. Well, the whole area of accommodations is a really important one, and as Bennett indicated, having children and young adults be able to use the keyboard and the computer is really an important accommodation. In the same way, we've learned, getting back to reading specifically, is that children and adults who are dyslexic, and we know that invariably that word form area that allows fluent rapid reading is not working efficiently. And so what we always say is dyslexia robs a person of time people are slow readers, so a critical accommodation for particularly for high-stakes examination is to have those who are dyslexic have additional time. Just as a person who's diabetic requires insulin, a person who's dyslexic requires extra time. And now we're very gratified that there's actually neurobiologic evidence showing that the word form area is disrupted so that the individual just cannot read quickly.
Can we back up a bit? I want to look at the sequence of events that has to occur in order for us to read words on a page. Our eyes are tracking, as I understand it. That's moving along the sentence in English from left to right. Does it matter whether we're going left to right, right to left, whether we're going up and down, as some languages require?
No. What does sometimes, it doesn't matter which direction. But interestingly, I was speaking to someone who taught at a Hebrew school. And she was relating that some of the children there who have reading difficulties, and if they take English and Hebrew, end up reading one line from left to right and the next line from right to left.
So they just go back and they...
Right.
Well, that would be an interesting way. Then your eyes don't have to keep on moving, because when you watch someone read, it looks as though the eyes are jumping from word to word. Is that what's happening? Does the phrase fixation point apply here?
I think what's been learned, and there's a great deal of information from studies of examining actually eye tracking during reading, but what has been learned is that individuals actually read the word and decode the word individually. Now, when you're a skilled reader, you essentially see the word and you know what it means. But the fastest readers often just jump, don't read every word on the page. They're essentially looking at a few words and getting the meaning.
They're filling in the gaps?
Words. They're filling in the gaps, yeah. So when you hear someone who reads 400 pages an hour or something that sounds magical, that's probably what they're doing. They're so familiar with the text and the different kinds of text that they just have to read a few words on the page to get the gist of it. And your readers will, your listeners will probably understand this. When you're really expert in something, the vocabulary in that area of expertise keeps repeating. So,
although I remember Woody Allen's joke about speed reading War and Peace in 20 minutes, he said, "It's about Russia, isn't it?" because that is part of the problem. If with something really wonderful, you want to slow down and savor what you're reading, that's a whole other matter. A listener who is dyslexic wonders if reading aloud is harder for people who are dyslexic. You say that dyslexics read slower, but reading aloud also slows us down, doesn't it?
Reading aloud does slow us down, and very often for people who are dyslexic, it really is something very difficult, because when you're reading to yourself, nobody knows what you're reading. No one knows if you're making up words in place of the ones you can't read or if you're daydreaming. If you have to read aloud in a public place, for example, Passover is coming soon. And for those who celebrate and sit down at a Seder where you go around the table reading, you always can notice a relative as they try to read aloud who stumbles over words or reads slowly or loses her place. So reading aloud, in one sense, is more difficult in terms of in a public venue. On the other hand, many, many people who are dyslexic find it helps if they subvocalize while they're reading.
Now, dyslexic, go ahead.
It may slow them down, but it helps them articulate the word much more accurately.
Now, dyslexics also talk about switching letters, but Michael in Brooklyn left a comment on our show page. He said he was given a paragraph to read where all the letters in the words were mixed up except the first and last letters of each word, and he found it surprisingly easy to read. He was filling in the gaps? Is that what you were describing earlier?
I that would be the most reasonable explanation.
Because he kind of knew by context,
right,
what those words
exactly
would be.
And this is what happens to people who are dyslexic, because we're talking about sounding out words, but part of reading is having a vocabulary, having background knowledge. And also what we know now about people who are dyslexic, what's not affected are the higher order, not only language functions, but reasoning, thinking, conceptualizing. So they can figure out what the point is, what the idea is. And in fact, many of our most creative people are dyslexic. If you look at a range of different occupations and you look at the people at the top who've made a difference, who've had a new idea, those people are very often, more than you would predict, are dyslexic.
A lot of our leading artists, for example.
And writers. John Irving is dyslexic, and the late Wendy Wasserstein was dyslexic. So it's artists, architects, but creative people in general, including writers.
Go ahead.
And fields that you wouldn't even imagine a person could function in if they were dyslexic. Take law. Probably one of our greatest living attorneys, who is absolutely brilliant and very successful, David Boies, is quite dyslexic.
Francesca from New Jersey, how you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to put on a throw in a point about myself and my son. My younger son and myself are dysgraphic, at least that's what we have been described as. And my elder son, who is 40 now, is totally dyslexic, completely dyslexic. Now, my question is more with the dysgraphia part, because I find I cannot understand anything by hearing it. I have to read it. I have to see the shape of it, and then I can pronounce it.
Now, does that matter, Francesca, whether you are speaking English or Spanish?
It doesn't matter. Well, with Spanish, of course, it's phonetical. That's easy. But again, when I write it, I don't have so many problems with spelling in Spanish, but grammatically, the rules of grammar, I am 67 years of age now. The rules of grammar, I have never achieved them, not in English, not in Spanish, not in German. And Spanish and German are phonetical, so that's fine. But English, of course, I still make many mistakes. You will find my work is very funny because I'm a judicial interpreter.
We have very little. Oh, you're an interpreter. We have very little time. Do you have anything to say to Francesca? Any explanation?
It would be very unusual for people who are dyslexic to have difficulties with grammar and syntax, not unheard of. And one of the approaches to help people with dyslexia is a multisensory one, where you see the word, you hear it, you even feel the shape of it. And so I think having those ancillary modalities, particularly in seeing it, is very helpful to you.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the Audrey G. Ratner Professor in Learning Development at Yale University, the Yale Center for Learning, Reading, and Attention, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, the Charles and Helen Schwab Professor in Dyslexia and Learning Development at the Yale University School of Medicine, Chief of Pediatric Neurology and Co-Director of the Yale Center for Learning, Reading, and Attention. Both of them are also with the newly founded Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.